break. It's a mini episode.
Hello and welcome to another mini-sode of You Gotta Check This Out with Mike and Dre. I'm the Mike, and today's episode is packed with outtakes from our episode with MVB. He regales us with the tale of JMS's wad of cash for a confused fan. Then, we continue with alien makeup ratings and the one Babylon 5 scene that MVB actually truly enjoyed. I'll see you at the other end.
But Michael, how did you get involved, if you don't mind me asking, with all of, we all know you from every of the major podcasts.
I don't remember.
It was like in a daze and just started drawing.
It's been a long while. I think I worked with Small Beans first. I wrote an article or two for crack.com back in the day. I do remember how I got involved with Gamefully Unemployed, which was kind of funny. There was Small Beans was doing a show called Off Hours, which was like a continuation of After Hours. And I pitched a script to them, which it was called Why Fox Mulder is a Monster. And they read it. They read the script and they were like, is this based on the Gamefully Unemployed show? The observations were different and everything, but the premise was the same. I had no idea that show existed. So Abe Epperson sent me a link and I just went and listened to all of it. It's the funniest thing in the world. So I contacted them and I said, I have this idea for a t-shirt that I don't know what to do with. And it was just the premise was they kind of arrest the Fluke Man in the Fluke Man episode of the X-Files. And I thought it'd be really funny to show his court case in the form of a courtroom sketch. And I was like, if you guys want it, I'll do that for you. And they took it. So that was the first thing I did for them. And then we've done like 100 things.
And did you do like a Mulder punching ET at one point? I think is one image that's popping.
Yeah, I did. That was for their, I did a big piece of channel artwork for them where I had the two of them playing a board game with everything that they podcast about in it. And in the foreground, I had Mulder punching out ET and that got cut out and used for a t-shirt.
And to just keep waxing effusive about you, if you have not checked out Michael's art, like again, mvbramley.art, this is like the wildest thing about me to you, almost in that comic vein, the George Perez or whatever. It's the, you get a big scene and that's what I commissioned you for back in the day. Go check out the Nerd Christmas card. And when I pitched it in my head, I was like, okay, just make a generic Christmas tree and maybe add a few Easter eggs and we're good. And you drew like an individual character for every ornament for at that time, every episode of Nerd. And they, for Gamefully, they cut out pieces of that giant piece of artwork. So that's even more remarkable to me because these little tiny bits of that overarching sketch were all good enough on their own to be their own pieces. So
I think one of my favorite pieces of art that I've just stared at for a while is the Spiel Boys thing that you did for Gamefully Unemployed. I love that.
I was really, really happy with how that came out. That was a real joy to work on. I sat here with a Drew Struzan art book open and just tried my hardest to kind of channel what he does. But no, I was really proud of the Spiel Boys piece.
Cool. In our pre-talk, sir, that you did have an early meeting possibly with JMS. I wondered if that was part of your Babylon 5 knowledge beforehand, or if that's all aside from all the comic stuff you've done and conventions.
I met him several years ago at a comic convention by chance. It was about 20 years ago. It would have been one of the first ever New York Comic Cons. I didn't live here yet. And I was walking through the artist alley and I saw his table set up and I'd been reading. I don't know if they were calling that part the writer's block yet or whatever, but
to give a brief interjection on stuff we've talked in the past, if you read the book Becoming Superman, it's wild because JMS had this very prolific 80s period. And then the 90s kind of post Babylon 5 had a bit of a lull before Changeling. Changeling has kind of turned and now he's a big name again. So you basically had to have probably hit him in that era where he had kind of fallen from grace from mainstream TV before he hit the movies big.
So he was making comics a lot during this period. Between the late 90s and the mid 2000s, he was very prolific as a comic writer. I first became aware of him because I was reading Amazing Spider-Man, which he had a very long, very controversial run on that I actually enjoyed very much. So I knew him as a comic writer, and I followed him to Joe's Comics, where he had like his own imprint. I think it was for Top Cow or
Yeah, it was a rising star, right?
Yeah, I read Rising Stars, yeah.
Yep, that's where I first heard of him.
But the yeah, I knew he was the writer of Babylon 5, but I never went back and watched Babylon 5. So I was excited to see him at the Artist Alley, and there was just one other guy just right in front of me. As I was walking to the table, this younger guy sort of stepped up to see him, and he says, "So I'm really happy to meet you. My best friend, he's the biggest Babylon 5 fan." And this young guy, I think he's like 17, 18. He's telling Straczynski that his friend wanted to come to New York Comic Con just to meet Straczynski. And without skipping a beat, Straczynski stands up, he gets his wallet out of his pocket, and he's, "What would it cost to bring him in?" He starts counting out $20 notes, like one after the other. And I'm watching it like my eyes are super wide. I see him, he's counting like 80, 100, 120. It's just going up and up. And he had this big wad of cash, presumably from selling at the convention, because it was back before card payments and whatnot. And this, yeah, long story short, the kid, he was trying to help this kid bring his best friend to the show to meet him. The kid got scared and just kind of left. And I watched him just sort of, I watched
Ah, what a cash!
just sadly put his money back in his wallet and shrink back down into his chair. And I was like, I think he was like embarrassed, because when I went and spoke to him, I'm like, "I'm a big fan of Spider-Man." He's like, "Yeah, whatever." That was my one in-person interaction with him. And then about a year later, 2 years later, when One More Day came out, that was
Yeah,
the most
that was the big
controversial
controversial ending one. Yeah.
when that came out, I kind of learned that if you mentioned his name on the internet at any point during that period, he would show up. So my friend was writing, wrote like a think piece about One More Day in his life journal or something, and there is Straczynski in the comics saying, "Yeah, editorial forced on me. It's not my fault." So I think,
Yeah,
like,
he's like a real life Mr. Mix-ix Picklick like
yeah,
that,
you could, if you said his name, it was like Beetlejuice. He'd show up. And I've always thought that
right?
those two things, that's pretty much all I know about him as a person, but like those two things tell you that he was struggling with his fame, I think. Like he tried to do this really nice thing for a fan. And I've never seen anything like that before or since. At the time, I thought that was amazing. And I told my friends about it, and they're like, "That's kind of creepy, right? What was he?"
Well, I will throw this out again. We cannot recommend Becoming Superman enough. And for a lot of reasons, as Evil Mike knows, Evil Michael is right. Evil Michael, there we go. He does bring up neurodiversity and autism. And I think something about him that I think we can all appreciate as creators that I've been seeing as I've been listening through directors' commentaries, of which the episode we're going to be covering, Severed Dreams, does have. JMS has that artist thing of this weird combination of arrogance with self-hatred, right? He is a fantastic writer and he knows it. He has good stuff. He has grand ambitions. And at the same time, he's probably harder on his episodes of Babylon 5 than a lot of his people on the internet. So that is always a weird combination to get into, as you're saying, when you're noticing out of artists, really good artists especially, are very funny in this combination of being incredibly competent, incredibly good, and then you like watch them in other areas and they stumble
Well,
and you're
it
like,
goes into my mountain theory that I do all the time, because as a musician, I feel that so much. It's like I have to ask any other musician I talk to, because I deal with both musicians who are just starting out and guys who I look up to that I get to play with all the time now. And I always ask them, like, "Where are you at in the mountain? Where is your mountain?" And what I mean that is, like, my guitar teacher has a master's in jazz performance. He plays with all the best people around Chicago. And I know that he still has hangups about, like, his ability. And there's stuff that he can't get to. There's parts of the mountain he can't climb. So I may see him way up there at the mountain, and I have to keep where I'm at the same mountain very much in check of myself. Because if I envision it like that, I know, oh, this is where I am at the climb. I will get there someday. I will never get to the top, but at least every other musician and artist I know is going through the same climb on some level. This thing that we have as artists, where we're so down on ourselves so much, but we have to have all that ego behind it at the same time.
yeah, it is a strange mix, or it seems like it, but it's actually, I think it's quite common, those attributes, the arrogance, and then the self-loathing, and finding, I don't know, I think I see it a lot in people, but with him specifically, I know there's a, it struck me that there was a lot of introspection there, and I guess he never tried to hide that he cared what people thought, I think.
I do appreciate that, because I think it's very disingenuous. It's like, that's why we all do this stuff, right? Like, any one of us, you could do your amazing drawings just for you. Mike could play his music just for himself or everybody else in his house. I mean, I do. If I wasn't talking into a microphone for the internet, I do just walk around and talk to myself. So you can do that. So it's like, if you're doing something for an audience, of course you care what people think. It's great to have you both on the episode together, because you both basically formed the Nerd Show. And that we had a season of Nerd, patreon.com/Jeff May, that I did basically on, I called it like comic origins. And the way it was really framed is not like origins of comics. It was like a comic from your childhood that shaped you. And I did the first with Impulse. And then we got two guests, and the two guests were Michael. And we did do Marvel versus DC. We wanted to do a Spider-Man arc, but it was too ambitious. And I will throw this to you. We have had multiple hits now. TJ Shevlin was another guest recently on Nerd talking about One More Day with JMS. But he brought, we talked Robin on that. So TJ Shevlin talked Robin on the Nerd podcast.
It was a good conversation about that One More Day, because he it is a really well-written comic. It was just forced upon him by Marvel to end the MJ Peter Parker marriage.
Weirdly enough, only to get into the weeds on Spider-Man, but that was kind of the problem with every Spider-Man comic for 20 years, was that they were all editors trying to resolve that relationship one way or another. That's how we ended up with the Clone Saga, and we ended up with, they killed Mary Jane off on a plane ambiguously for a while before Straczynski, and then his run ended that way. He had a different solution for it that I think he believed was more elegant. I didn't. Yeah, nobody read it because it didn't get published, but it was going to be a time travel thing and involve Loki, I believe.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to stay there too a while, because I loved that run. That was during a time when both Karen and I were picking up every single issue of every Spider-Man magazine at every comic in the mid-aughts. And I really appreciated his take on Spider-Man, because he really kind of made him fit more as an adult than he ever really had before. Like, he gave, even to Aunt May, he gave a lot of good stuff to, because she knew he was Spider-Man and really embraced that part of the story. And it was really refreshing to see.
I 100% agree. He was a lot of people didn't like that they made him into a teacher, but I always...
That's right.
I actually really appreciated that, because the idea of him, I mean, that being the level that he's kind of stuck at as an adult presented more problems for him. I never liked the stuff afterwards where they made him into a tech CEO, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But no, the teacher thing was perfect. It still got the school setting. He was always kind of best in that high school, in the college setting, and the way to actually advance the character and kind of keep that going with those stories are, hey, keep him in school, but make it where an adult would be as a teacher. He can teach the responsibility in ways. So I can find those stories that they haven't told yet.
I'd also say it has my single favorite Spider-Man page in all of Spider-Man history. And I've read a lot of Spider-Man, but it's Peter Parker climbing the side of a building without his mask, because he doesn't have a costume on him. And he stops by a window and somebody sees him, but the guy who sees him is prancing around in women's underwear, and they just stop and pause and they say, "I won't tell if you won't." Deal. And then they just keep going. Like, nothing.
Lock eyes. We got this.
Give for either of us, right? No.
So I do, brilliant. I'm going to have to say more Spider-Man has to be coming at some point. Clone Saga is a dream someday. But yes,
in the camp where Spider-Man is the best superhero of all time. I put Spider-Man above Superman, Batman, Robin, any of the stuff. I think he has the best rogues galleries, even just above Batman's too. So these are huge conversations for another day, but yeah, I'm huge into Spider-Man.
Yeah, so sorry to yank Spider-Man away from you. We'll get back to this. So we've got the Babylon 5. I'm assuming we'll kind of do a little bit of organic talk.
Yeah, we're not going to gloss over the incredibly embarrassing intro to the show, are we?
Really? Everybody, interesting.
They show headshots of people turning to the camera and making a little face that tells you who they are.
I got to know who they are somehow, and I got to know what kind of face they make, right? Oh, that, that
I
does
do
it.
Like
he makes that
where...
face. He makes that face.
It's fascinating. Well, okay, let's ask a few things. What if the, so the CGI is dated. We'll give you that.
Yeah, I'll take
and
it.
The intro, I'll say, is dated. I mean, that's the thing. That's what shows would do back. That was very 90s.
I mean, look, I've watched a ton of 90s shows. Like, we mentioned all of the Star Treks. We mentioned, and I mean, I've watched all of the X-Files, I think. I used to be a huge Buffy fan when I was a kid. I don't remember any of the... Yeah, this felt more like something from a sitcom, like where they have all the characters turning and smiling. But from the intro, I'll give them this. I did know that one guy who sneers at the camera must be pretty mean.
I will give... That is jarring.
Shows you what you need to know about everybody. Ooh, I like the juxtaposition of that, like, insane... Everything that they're saying, all the explosions, the dun-dun music, all as the music each season gets more and more intense... But they keep the sitcom-y look set for everybody.
I think even for the 90s, this must have looked dated. I think because I think we're all about the same age. When you see this, saw this stuff live in the 90s when you were young, maybe it feels different looking back on it now.
That is one of my favorite things to see is a nostalgic cultural blind spot. Yeah. That's what this show is. And we're seeing it firsthand, right? You have a blind, like you said, you like Star Trek, X-Files, mm-hmm. etc., Buffy. You saw all this stuff in the 90s. This would have been right up there with you. I'll posit, if you had watched this live then, you might be in the same boat as me and Mike. Oh, isn't it amazing? You don't see it and you're like, what the absolute heck? And I've had those exact moments on things that I just happened to miss. Yeah. So this is 100% my jam to see it. And it's also fun to see the parts where I'm like, but what about the music? And you're like, what about the funny headshots of thing? And I'm like, yeah.
And also when the faces pop up on the screen, there are things that are kind of accidentally funny about them, like the makeup, pretty bad, mm-hmm. up until that last guy, because those lizard people look amazing. They look like they stepped in from a better show.
And then the boneheads, which are not always connected correctly to their face, you can see.
And there's one of them looks like Dana Carvey.
The Lanier?
I don't know his name, but he's in the episode. He's in both of the episodes I watched, but he looks like Dana Carvey.
He's one of the bonehead Minbari, right? With the ears down below. Yeah, that's got to be.
That design is so silly. And then I guess Londo from the previous scene, he's one of the peacock head people.
Yep, they just got to do this hair upright. So it's not nearly as much as what the Narn had to go through for the lizard makeup.
That is low-hanging fruit because that hair... It takes it a couple seasons to even look decent. And for a lot of it, it just looks like a bunch of people with bedhead.
Those characters look and sound, for all the world, like racist propaganda for an ethnicity I didn't know existed. I don't know how, it feels like if somebody shared that as like a picture of Londo in a meme or something, I would just assume, oh, this person's racist and block them before. it feels... wrong in a way that I can't quite articulate. There's just something there. I don't know.
Well, the thing that bothers me the most every time I see it now, and I can't unsee it, is one of the lead actor aliens, Delenn, she has the absolute worst makeup job because she's the one that she's half Minbari and half human. So she has the hair. Really, it was because after season one, she just refused to I'm not going in the makeup chair that much. You got to do something with my character. But you could see putty. There's just putty sticking out of the side of her bone.
One episode as a kid, I saw that one episode of Babylon 5 where she steps out of the chrysalis or whatever. Yep. And I remember thinking at the time, I guess she didn't want to wear the prosthetics anymore.
I don't think that was explicitly it. I do think it was planned, but I do even know in the director's commentary brought that up, that they had to improve the makeup and that was a lot of learn by doing. And I know you've even said this, Mike, in some of his writing, where JMS is like, yeah, I had to ramp up to get things where I wanted, but I also had to release it all. And so what's funny is, on the one hand, like, if JMS ever hears this, he might be mad, but even on his own director's commentaries, he'll agree. And it is not surprising that an artist such as yourself is seeing the things. And like I said, I can't defend them because you're right. He, in the director's commentary, even mentions that her head was barely because of the hair and stuff was held on by two pieces of tape here, right at the temple. And she has a lot of action. She has action in this episode and they actually didn't even rig the prop correctly. In this episode, she's going to break a staff.
Yes.
And it wasn't rigged correctly. So she kept missing takes. And it's she's got this piece of bone on her head that barely holds on. And they're go in that room and crack the staff. And it's, you do 10 takes of that. And then the thing is crooked. And You know what? You got me. I can't defend
In
it.
fairness, again, I'm probably going to keep making Star Trek comparisons here, but I have watched some of the more high def versions of old Trek and noticed you don't want to see a close up of a Vulcan's ears or of like Worf's makeup. You can see the glue holding the nose on and everything. It doesn't. None of it really looks good close up.
Yeah, it's like going from watching regular TV to motion smoothness out of nowhere. Yep. That happened to me at a movie party one day. I'm like, what happened to TV?
Yeah, has it always been this?
Yeah.
But no, I mean, they're making Aliens on a budget. And I guess my issue is more with the design. I mean, I grew up on Doctor Who. I've got a big Doctor Who poster up there. I don't know if you see it.
But again, I'm going to say that's the proof. Because I remember I actually watched, I was not into Doctor Who younger. I got into it older and I watched whatever one of the more recent reboot, like
the BBC
reboot.
By recent,
I mean whatever, like in the 90s. And there's this episode with like Stretch Skin or something. And I watched it and I was like, I'm out.
That was the first one when they revived it, the Stretch Skin.
It all looks terrible. Even now. I mean, the budget on BBC shows is terrible.
Well, that's what kind of brought me through season one of Babylon 5. I was like, oh, this is like Doctor Who level quality. Okay, I can accept this. And once I had that in my mind, season one I got through.
This might be worse than Doctor Who quality. I mean, from a design standpoint, especially just some of these characters just look so bad to me. The bonehead people and the peacock people. And yet, and then just randomly, you've got the nuns, I guess they're called. And they look fucking incredible.
Yeah, the lizards.
The nuns, the design is great. The prosthetics look great. And it just seems like
if I may, before we will move us on the plot, but what I'm noticing, and I actually appreciate, and tell me if this is a nice unifying theory, I am noticing that the juxtapose for you is really jarring, and I'm digging that.
Yeah.
Because I think for myself, what I am able to do in a lot of things is I am able to enjoy the part I like and ignore the part I don't. And one thing I do focus on a lot of is narrative story. So I'd love Babylon 5 for that. And I'm able to let go of some of the bad special effects. And what you're saying is the bad stuff stands out. But what you're also pointing out is
the good stuff makes the bad stuff look worse.
When the bad stuff is next to the good, it makes it look worse.
Yeah.
The Narn, literally, that you're pointing this out, the first scene where you have the Narn with good acting and amazing special effects next to the guy who, I mean, and Peter Jurisic, who plays Londo, is an amazing actor, but you're right. He's doing an accent, and you are not incorrect to be like, feels racist. I don't think it's racist, but it feels. I agree with that. So the juxtapose, and I can definitely dig it. And this is not going to be the first juxtapose this episode. And I do remember Star Trek First Contact. And that's probably one of the only good Star Trek movies, if we're being honest, with apologies. Like, Wrath of Khan and that.
I like First Contact until Data starts coming in the middle of the movie. Like, in the scene with the Borg Queen, it kind of all falls apart for me there. I didn't like the guttle. I didn't want to see
I did love the end line of that, though, like the conclusion of that with Data, where did you think about betraying us? And he was like, yeah, for 0.xx seconds. He's like, for an android, that's an eternity. And the computer guy, I thought that was funny. I dug that.
One thing we did skip over, though, I noticed that I definitely wanted to bring up this episode earlier before all of the Delenn stuff was the ISN takeover.
Oh, yeah. And I had conjoined those two because basically we do have ISN talking about the Mars bombings. And I say it did get, they basically did admit that they're getting taken over and get shoved out of their building. So
yeah,
that
but
does
happen. One thing we didn't get to say was that I thought that was one of the better parts of the episode, that may have gotten it up for the Hugo, because it was showing how these overreaching governments will take over their own population first. They will take over the media first. And it was a very visceral idea of how it happens as the shock troops are coming in to take over the ISN reporters.
Yeah.
It was, and what I noticed, not coming back in till later on the seasons, they have a different reporter that's on all the ISN broadcasts. And it's almost tearful when with the same woman who's in this broadcast who gets hauled off is reinstated later in the series after the Clark regime is gone.
I actually really liked that. That was my favorite scene in the episode. Are these regulars on the show up until this point?
Yeah, and Sue, I don't know if the man is, the woman certainly is, which is the background, and the man does hop in. And the report that goes on that Mike is right, I basically glossed over was, they're reporting on Clark's terrible things. The guy's just like, hey, I got to jump in. We've been staying silent. We got to be honest. There are things we aren't allowed to tell you. Clark's telling us to do this. We're about to get taken over. Like, they're doing things outside. And if I don't say it now, who knows when we can? And so that is this episode has every, they're about to get taken over by President Clark. We've seen the media fall. We've seen the resistance basically get trounced. And so this episode really is hitting like a point of no return. And like, our heroes are really bad.
Yeah, that's why I thought it was ironic that this wasn't titled Point of No Return as opposed to the last episode.
That scene with the reporters, I thought it was done very well. Obviously, there are parallels to...
Yeah. Oh, there's a lot of parallels right now going Babylon 5.
So far, all of the scenes you've liked of this sci-fi show with regulars, you've been like, the scene I like is that person who's not regular on the show just doing dialogue.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sci-fi. A simple thing. And I feel like it's an odd thing. Maybe it's a trope. Maybe I've seen something like this before a few times, but I thought it worked well here. It's a good exposition scene. They're trying to... it also advances the plot. But I like the idea that they changed the newscaster after this. That's a nice little bit of world building too.
Oh, and it's, as Mike is mentioning, it's heartbreaking when they're like, ISN is back. Maybe it's good. And it's a new person. And they're like, President Clark is the best. And you're like, oh, good.
Yeah, they're like, everything President Clark has done is good. Martial law is in and everybody loves it because crime is down.
It's interesting. We have all of these, like science fiction did this so many times across all media where they predicted a fascist uprising or told a story that parallels real life fascist uprisings. And nobody predicted that this stuff would be happening as loudly as it happens in the real world. Like, from what I gather from this episode, people on Earth don't know what's going on, really. Mm-hmm. And most people are kind of happy with the state of things because there's kind of a media blackout on all of the bad stuff that the government is doing, so they just don't know about it.
It's like my whole life, I never realized how effective propaganda really was. Yeah. I always seemed like something was in stories. I mean, one of the first books that I picked up when I got to college was Manufacturing Consent by Noam Chomsky. As you can watch it slowly happen, but what can you do? It's if you say something, you're the black sheep, you're ostracized. Yeah. If you don't say something, you're just watching your worst nightmares come true around you. And that's what I think got this the Hugo, because it really showed that. It's Sheridan when that rack focus I meant earlier, when he hears that, oh no, it has nothing to do with your actions of what you did by giving the ship sanctuary. They already targeted you, and no matter what you did, they were going to take you down. I think that is what this show does well. And you kind of got to ignore all of the makeup and the putty and stuff.
I'll reiterate, I did not have a great time watching these episodes of this show, but if I understand the appeal through moments like this, I guess. And particularly, again, if you've been with it from the start, if you got it in its 90s context originally, I can understand.
Yeah.
And at that point, Michael Vincent Bramley's heart grew 15 sizes. He went on to become one of the biggest Babylon 5 supporters in the New York community. Just kidding, he actually gave me a wedgie, took my lunch money before shivving me from behind. Join us next week after my recovery, where we cover Babylon 5, Season 3, Episodes 16 and 17, War Without End. Cheers, all.
All right, are you cool if I do the intro, Mike?
Oh, always. It's yours.
I'll allow. Oh, sorry, Mike. Right.
Yeah, Mike. By the way, lean into that as much as you want. Talk over. It's not hard. We got multi-tracks. We can edit around.